Good evening, everybody, and welcome to the Spin It Social Hour. How is everyone tonight? Wow, I am excited. Today is our first time. Tonight is our first time moving to primetime on Thursday at 9 p.m. Eastern Time, every other Thursday. I am honored to be here tonight to bring on another great photographer. So, the Spin It Social Hour is a labor of love that I started about since the pandemic started. And my goal is to be here to help photographers tell their stories, show their work, and get their names out there. I am a social media and visual strategist, as I said. I've worked with the likes of the Pulitzer Prizes, AARP, and many, many others. I also teach at FIT. I'm really excited to start my new class next week at FIT, teaching the fundamentals of social media. I know I'm going to have a great class. And with everything going on in social media these days, especially what the buildup has been to 2021, have a lot of wisdom to impart to them, and it's going to be a great year. So, but tonight we are here to talk about Richard Burnaby. I learned about Richard a while ago. I've been a big fan and everything. To bring him on and show his work is just a thrill. So I'm going to give him the buildup that he deserves right now. And here we go. Photography was and is simply an extension of my love and passion for nature and wild places. That's all it is. I was doing lots of hiking, backpacking, and fly fishing trips when I got started, and I was carrying a camera with me to document it all. After a while, the desire to return with better pictures became a thrill, and I began to study how to improve with each and every trip, says Richard Burnaby, the renowned nature, wildlife, and travel photographer and author. His passion for adventure has been the driving force behind his quest to capture the character and moods of the world's most amazing places, from Africa to the Amazon, as well as countless places in between. Richard was named one of the top 30 influential photographers on the web by the Huffington Post and included in the 20 photographers changing the world through social media by Influence Digest. With 11 books and more than 1 million social media followers, as well as being a contributing editor at Popular Photography, Richard lectures frequently on all matters of photography, adventure travel, and the natural world. Richard adds, "I can honestly say that my proudest achievement as a professional outdoor nature photographer is the fact that I've never photographed a wedding, someone's baby, or anything else that I wasn't personally interested in. I told a friend when I quit the corporate world in 2003 that if he ever got word of me shooting a wedding, he could assume that things were going badly." Folks, I have to tell you, these are the photos I needed this week, and I know they were the photos that you needed too. It's an absolute pleasure to be here and to bring on the great Richard Burnaby. Richard, how are you?
Well, that was quite the buildup. Thank you. It's good to be here.
Oh, it's a pleasure, man. It is one of the things I love to do is to be able to put together those opening slideshows and go through, edit all of the work, which I did for years as a former photo editor at the New York Times. And it brought me back to my roots as usual. We've had a few weeks off. Edward's here. Good evening, Edward. And Janet's here. Love the white horses and the ponies. We're getting a lot of people chiming in. Andrew Kavanaugh is here. Three great Facebook groups on photography and social media. But Richard, thank you for being here. And so tell me, what have you been doing to keep busy lately?
Well, I'm not going to lie. It's been a difficult 9, 10, 11 months.
I know.
With somebody who travels, it not only was a setback for my business, but it was part of my lifestyle. It was something I was always on the move and exploring new places, and suddenly all that came to an end almost a year ago. I think it was January of last year. I was in Iceland, and then I went to London, spent some time with my daughter, and then up to Norway. And then as I was coming back from Norway, this would have been about mid-February, okay, going through Heathrow. It was a ghost town, and I knew something was definitely up. It wasn't just a virus that was going to be a short time thing. It was going to be serious, and here we are. But
yeah, I know, man.
Some writing and and some travel here in the U.S. and some big road trips, but I haven't gotten on a plane and flown out of the country since that February.
Yeah, I know. And it's been hard on everybody. And, you know, I started to show off upbeat because I want to make this, you know, we're all breathing easier today. I don't even need to go there, but we're all breathing easier. So, you know, we're hoping that, you know, we'll get these vaccines rolled out, and we're hoping that we'll be able to travel again. But for tonight, we're going to live the world through your eyes, man. And wow, that is exciting, because to me, you're one of the top photographers out there. And when I look at your photos, it brings that whole feeling of wanderlust, you know, and the desire to travel with that passion and purpose that you have. So, you know, I'm going to get right to it here with some of the questions, because we have a lot to cover. And one of the things I want to ask you is, what is the one place that, you know, that you haven't been to that you would love to visit, and why?
Yeah, I've got this list of places, and it changes, but the South Georgia Island has always been one of, it's an island way down in the Southern Atlantic Ocean with mountains and sea of penguins. And I had an opportunity to go last year, but the trip was canceled. I'll have another trip later this year, hopefully everything goes well. That was always been near my top as a wildlife landscape, just a very remote place. It feels remote. It's got that feeling of being kind of lost in the Southern Atlantic. And another place has been Russia, would have been the Kamchatka Peninsula. And for those of you who love the outdoors and love wild places, all I can say is bears, volcanoes, and there's nothing else to say.
That's pretty good. I mean, bears and volcanoes. I could
bears, volcanoes. What else do you need?
I mean, no. You know, you get the action, and you get the beauty of lava and everything else. So, I have to tell you, man, putting together the next slideshow that we're going to go through of your work was just as big of a treat, of course. And I had to start off with this beauty, and I'm just going to let you tell the story here, Richard.
Okay, well, it's not an original concept. For those who know a little bit about travel photography, it's it's in China. It's on the I think it's the Li River, and this is an old gentleman who's been doing this a long time. It's they use the cormorants that you see perched on the bow of his little raft. There's an art to it where there's a string tied to its neck, and the cormorants dive and catch fish, and they come back up, and then the fisherman takes the fish out of its mouth. Cruel, but it's an ancient craft in a way that they would fish. This is not an actual cormorant fisherman, but he was there early in the morning. It was kind of overcast day, so we got those moody blues of twilight, and then the lanterns kind of lighting him up there. But it's a well-known place for this type of image, and I want to do something a little bit different with the lighting, but I'm pretty happy with the way it turned out.
That lighting looks good to me, man. The early bird, you know, the early bird gets it, right? So it's just gorgeous. But, you know, let's roll through some of these. Take us on a trip through your eyes, man.
Okay. This is a rock formation off the coast of Southern Iceland. It's called Reynistrangur. And there's an old fable about, because the people of Iceland love elves, and they like stories about elves and this fantasy kind of thing. And this is apparently I think it's a dragon. It's a dragon and some elves on a ship, and they're having a tug of war in the middle of the ocean. And then the sun comes up and they all turn to stone. And this is what this formation represents. But this is a kind of a dangerous place to get to. The beach is rather dangerous anyway, because it's sloped. So the waves come up on you quickly. There's a lot of rogue waves. And in order to get to this spot so that you're looking at the formations dead on, you've got to climb over some rocks and go through some keyholes that you can only do at low tide. At high tide, it would be, or even middle tides, it's possible you can get trapped. And so, we had a really colorful sky, and I used some rocks in the foreground, went wide, centered the composition, went with an extra long exposure, probably a six-stop neutral density filter, just to kind of simplify the foreground and the image, so there wasn't a lot of ripples in the water and bumpy, you know, different light, diffracting right. light. And stuff. Just made right. it as simple as possible. And it's one of my all-time favorites and big sellers too.
Oh, man, you know, I was sitting here the other day with another nice glass of cup of coffee, and I was looking at it, and it just took me away, man. I mean, the colors are just absolutely sensational. The composition is flawless, in my opinion. And it's that haze, that purple, blue, just, you know, the tones to it and everything.
The long exposure helps that because it kind of it spreads that color out.
Right.
On the water and in the sky as well.
Right. Well, yeah, the water here looks like mist. I mean, it's not just water. It looks like just mist. So it's, you know, speaking of, you know, you do so many workshops and everything. Speaking of that, I wanted to ask you here in your workshops, how do you teach composition and how do you teach bringing all of these elements together? And you know, if you want to take the fifth on rule of thirds, we'll understand.
Yeah. That's a well-crafted little statement. You could have a question. When I teach composition, I start with the working definition of what composition is. And that is the arrangement of visual elements in the image frame. And so you may have read somewhere or some of the things I've read about seeing abstractly. And I think that's a huge step when teaching composition is learning how to see abstractly. And once that clicks, I see people's work really make that quantum leap. So when you talk about like the arrangement of visual elements, there's two types of visual elements. One is the literal elements, and that is where we're looking at a picture here, the mountains and clouds, and you can include trees, tangible things you can see and feel. Mm-hmm. And then there are abstract elements. And they would be things like shapes and lines and patterns, space. And sometimes it could be the same thing. It could be concurrent. It could be a triangle, for example, that shape or a rock that's a shape of a triangle. But if you had three different rocks, let's say of different sizes and shapes, mm-hmm. you can connect those to make an abstract triangle. And that's just kind of seeing the underlying geometry below the literal, below the surface.
Right.
So, you know, you want to enjoy the literal beauty of, you know, what you're photographing, but then you just kind of intuitively be able to see what's beneath the surface as far mm-hmm. as the abstract qualities of the photo.
Mm-hmm. No, you know, the elements that you put together. I mean, this photo here grabbed me for numerous reasons. I if I am correct, it was in Namibia, correct?
Yeah, it's a abandoned diamond mine. The diamond mining was very big in South Africa and Namibia both. And this was a community that built up around a mine in the earlier part of the 20th century. Mm-hmm. And they built houses, they had a hospital, they had a school. And sometime in the 50s, they just quit mining there. It either dried up or it wasn't cost efficient to keep working there. And the whole town just moved out. Mm-hmm. And because of the dry climate, the houses in the inside, there's you know, dozens of houses. They're relatively in good shape. You can see the paint is still, you know, considering this was in the 50s that they were abandoned. But it's also in the middle of a desert. So over the years that the wind has just blown the sand in and the desert is slowly taking over. So when you walk into these houses, it's surreal. I mean, it's like a Dali painting or something. So it's, you're trying to create, you know, strong, powerful compositions like this one, but then you have the sand that's coming through the windows and the doors. And it's just, I don't know of any other place in the world like it.
No, it's like I said, when I first saw it, we talked about this the other day, I thought it was from a sandstorm, you know, because you look at this and that's what came first into my mind. But, you know, now knowing that it's a mine, you know, just the depth with those windows or doors on the side there and all of the sand that is accumulated there in going up towards the other part of the picture, just really spectacular. And then you have, you know, the mountains and the clouds and the beautiful, tell us about this one here, man.
Yeah, it was, This is in the Smoky Mountains on Clemens Dome. It's the highest point in the park. This is the Smoky Mountains is kind of like my home park. Mm-hmm. And it was one of those dreary days. I was photographing this waterfall, and it's called Grotto Falls. And while I was there, there was a herd of llamas coming down the trail with this guy. And there's a lodge up on Mount LeConte where the only way they get supplies is through llama trains. There's no roads. Huh. So he was coming down, and I had conversation with him, and I said, wow, I bet it's really nasty weather up there. He says, no, it's actually perfectly clear. So I grabbed my stuff and I ran down the trail about a mile and a half down to my car, drove up the Clemens Dome through the fog, through the mist, and about a half a mile from the top, I just popped through the top of the clouds, and it was crystal clear. And you could look down, you know, around you to all the mountain ridges, and it was just rolling clouds below.
Yeah.
And I just waited till the sun went down, so I didn't have to, you know, worry about, you know, that. And right. So now what happens is I've got this golden glow in the sky that's remaining from the sunset, but now there's no direct light on the rolling clouds anymore. So it's picking up the blue that's reflecting from the sky. Mm-hmm. You have this great color temperature contrast. I extended the shutter out a little bit to 20 seconds to kind of give it a more of a smooth feeling. And this is what you see here. This is almost 10 years old. The last
time I saw something like this personally was when I was in Hawaii, and I was I believe it was on Mount Mauna Kea, and saw those types of rolling clouds and that effect that it gives you and everything. And they were pretty much up to my knees. I mean, it was just wild and, you know, captured absolutely beautifully here. We had a comment here from Edward Leskin. Edward says, Richard, what percentage of your images are researched ahead of time before you get on the plane, pre-visualized versus those that come up as expected and unexpected surprises, Edward asks?
That's a good question. It's a combination of both. If I'm traveling to a place I've never been before, I do just really basic research. Mm-hmm. So I know my way around. Mm-hmm. I may hire a guide to take me some places, but I purposely don't want to get on, say, Google Images and start looking at what other photographers have done, because it's going to influence me. Even if I don't want to allow myself to be influenced, it's going to be subconscious. The greatest tool I have as an artist, as a photographer, is my emotional reaction to a place when I see it for the first time. I want to take that emotion that I've had, whether it's, you know, that awe or that whatever it may be, and I want to build an image around that emotion. And if I take that away by doing too much research and allowing the images that I've seen to influence, mm-hmm. I kind of lose that. I want to be surprised. I want that feeling of seeing something for the first time to be my guide as to how I create an image. So I don't do too much research in that way. But there are places, particularly close to home, places I've been to many, many times that are really good images, but the conditions just aren't right yet. It could be, you know, that I didn't have the right sky or the direction of the light, the season. Maybe I'm waiting for the right fall color to shoot it or the right water levels. There's many different. It's already pre-visualized. It's already here in my head. I just have to go back with the right conditions. So it's right. A combination of two things.
Right. No, and Janet asks here. Janet's another very supportive viewer. Can you talk a bit about your camera gear, lenses and bodies or other use most? Thanks.
Okay. Hi, Janet. I use Canon gear. Right now, when the pandemic hit, I figured it was a good time to go ahead and maybe switch out from DSLRs to mirrorless, which I did. So right now, my primary body is the R5, and backup is just the R. And I've pretty much sold all my DSLRs at this point. And lenses, I have, you know, dozens of lenses. A lot of them just sit here in my office. Or I don't use, but when I travel, it's from the widest angle thing. I have 11 to 24 all the way up to, you know, 600.
Right. Well, you know, shooting wide was something I learned a long time ago from two great photographers that I worked with at the New York Times for years. One was Angel Franco, and the other one was the legendary Dith Pran. And Dith and both Angel one day looked at me and they said to me, hey, kid, ditch the long lens and go wide. Learn with wide first.
Yeah, and it's something you have to learn how to use it, because your initial impulse is, because it's wide, you want to capture as much as you can. And once you learn how to use it and the law of diminishing scale to create that depth, it's a powerful tool, no doubt.
Right. No, absolutely. It really is. You know, so Damon. Oh, Damon Brown's here. Wonderful. Damon does a lot of work with Inc. Magazine and many other publications. He's a great writer. Richard, asking as a fellow independent creator, do you focus more on photo bureaus or independent sales? And how has the evolution of photo bureaus over the years changed your business? Great question.
Okay. Yeah, I'm going to have to be a little ignorant on this one. I'm not sure what a photo bureau is, unless he's talking about like a stock agency. I'm not sure.
Damon will have to clarify.
He'll have to come back. But yeah, stock agency, yeah. I think we all know what's happened to that business
right.
in the past 20 years.
Right.
I still do a fair amount with Adobe and National Geographic Creative, but for the most part, it's just sort of passive income that I don't really spend a lot of time thinking about or working mm-hmm. on that much. Mm-hmm. If I go on many trips over the years, after a few months, I'll collect images and I'll send them. But yeah, we know what's happened there, and I don't know if that's coming back or not.
Yeah, there's been so many changes in the photo industry and journalism and everything. I mean, you know, in 2000, stock agency, Damon, okay, very yeah. good. I like Damon's quick. He came back with the, he did mean stock agency. So.
Stock agency, yeah. There's been a small renaissance, a micro renaissance in the last mm-hmm. 2 or 3 years. Mm-hmm. You see like Shutterstock having a premium brand and Adobe having a premium brand. And that's worked out a little bit, but it's still, I don't think that it's ever coming back. I just, if you look at the dynamics of the supply and demand,
right.
I mean, the demand is getting smaller and smaller. Supply is almost infinite now.
Right. Speaking of branding, we're going to take a quick break here just for a second, and I'm just going to let everybody know about one of the sponsors of this Minute Social Hour here. So let's let everybody know about the wonderful platform I use called StreamYard. All right. Thank you. StreamYard, it's an honor to have you sponsor Spin It Social Hour. Love streaming my show, the Spin It Social Hour, on StreamYard. And I also wanted to let everybody know that you can contact me at Spin It Social. I am a social media and visual strategist, as I said, live stream production, social media coaching. My email is spinitsocial@gmail.com. And there's my number. So open for business, and 2021. Ready for it. Let's do this. But we are here once again with Richard Burnaby, and we are going to go through some more work here. I've had the pleasure of putting together this week. And give me one second here. Something went off, and we are going to bring back all of those beautiful photos right now. There we go. So, Richard, I saw this. I wanted to be there. Let me tell you something. The contrast between the reds and the whites and the mountains and everything else. Where are we here, Richard?
Yeah, this is one of the last photos I took since before the pandemic. This is in Norway, in Lofoten Islands. And I just got really lucky with the snow, because that really makes it. It's a fresh snow. It just fallen. We have some clearing just so you see a little bit of blue up there, but without it being distracting. But this is another well-known shot. It's actually taken from a bridge, so it looks like like you're looking down from a drone shot or something.
Yeah.
But you know, this place, everywhere you turned, it was just one spectacular landscape after another. You're 100 miles north of the Arctic Circle. There are quite a bit of photographers around, particularly in the winter, mm-hmm. but this spot here is a well-known shot. It's a well-known image. There's really not a lot of creativity going on here. It's one that's been done before, but hitting it right there perfectly after the snow.
Yeah.
For that high in the Arctic, it's not as cold as you would think. It gets a lot of influence from the Gulf Stream. And
right.
So yeah, the red is striking.
timing is everything. And you were there for that fresh snow, and it just really just lit it up. It just absolutely, the light and everything. And then, of course, you know, the Northern Lights here. I've seen a lot of photos on the Northern Lights, but, you know, the beauty of this one is that the green just took over the entire frame.
Yeah. This is a strong storm, and those I've photographed the aurora in Alaska and Greenland, Iceland, Canada. If it's a weak storm, the green is just not that visible to the eye, and it has more to do with, you know, the physiology of the eye and how the eye works using, you know, rods instead of cones. But this was a really strong storm. I not only saw the green, I felt the green, and for me, more than anything else, because there's a million aurora photos out there, was getting a foreground that. In this case, you could see how it mimics the shape of the aurora,
right?
The reflection, in that this is a lagoon actually, but it's frozen, but just the edge there, it's open, so that it kind of creates that curve and completes the curve with the aurora.
Well, you know, the interesting thing about this photo that also made me think a lot about it, you know, we all see different things in photos, but we also reflect on, pardon the pun, but we also reflect on photos like this. I was thinking of many photos I've seen lately of the Hudson River in New York, because during the pandemic, the Hudson has been still. I mean, there's been no activity. So it's literally at night from many people who have taken many photos, have literally, it looks like a sheet of ice. So that when I saw this, the reflection of the aurora in the lagoon here, as you said, it has that same feel to it, you know? So, many of the reflections from the New York City skyline in the Hudson now are just so crystal clear at night. Yeah. So anyway. That's what it made me think of. But, you know, then you go to the another pun here, but the polar opposite of that, to, you know, one of the humongous icebergs, you know, with a huge sheet of ice falling down here. Where are we here, Richard?
This is called the Perito Moreno Glacier in Patagonia, Argentina, just outside of Calafate. And it's so I've been to many glaciers. This is by far the most beautiful glacier that I've been to, and it's one of the rare glaciers on Earth that's actually in equilibrium. It's not shrinking, it's not expanding. It's found a perfect equilibrium because of the slope and because the Southern Andes gets so much snow that it keeps piling on. So it's in perfect equilibrium. But just as it gets to the huge Lago Argentino, it starts calving, breaking off, just because it's cutting underneath it, and the pieces start breaking off. And I just so happened to be lucky to catch that one column of ice as it broke off and it hits the water.
Yeah, no, I've been near something like that once, and I have to tell you, in Alaska, and the thunderous like sound of it coming down and hitting the water is really something to hear, and also, you know, worry about, of course, with global warming and everything else, you know, given the amount of, of what's happening around the world and everything. And I've seen many of your polar bear photos and everything. You know, it's a difficult thing to deal with these days. I'm sure you were thrilled, as I was the other day, when you heard, I'm sure, that, you know, we're back in the Paris Climate Agreement.
Right.
And everything. So that's a great thing. One of the things I wanted to speak to you about, and I wanted to ask you about, was, actually we'll go to this one. Fine. Richard, how do you get an emotional reaction to landscape photography?
I think having an emotional reaction is a key really to doing good landscape photography. And it's one of the reasons why landscape photography may be the most challenging genre of photography. And I get this a lot from people come to my workshops or classes, is that they struggle with landscape. They like doing wildlife or portraits. And I think there's a couple of reasons. One reason is, I think if you do wildlife, it's pretty obvious what your subject is.
Right.
Or you're doing a portrait or, you know, something like that. With landscape, sometimes it's difficult to figure out what exactly is the subject. Okay, unless you're doing like a waterfall or something, but put somebody out in the middle of a forest, for example, and to get some shots, and it's too much confusion. There's nothing there
right
for your eye to focus upon to kind of work around. But the other reason is, I think, because the success of an image depends on its emotional content and how it resonates with other people emotionally. Mm-hmm. And, wildlife and people, let's say a person, a baby crying or baby smiling, universally, we all feel joy. Even certain animals, we can translate to that they're feeling something, or an animal's angry or animal is relaxed. Mm-hmm. We can translate those emotions easily through living things. It's much more difficult to extract emotional content from inanimate things like rocks, trees, mountains, for example. You've got to have a love for those places, for the outdoors, for the wild, mm-hmm. to be able to extract any kind of emotional content from those inanimate things. And so once you're able to connect emotionally, you know yourself, you know what you're feeling, then you have, like I said earlier, you have an emotional core around which to build an image, so that when other people see your images, they not only see what you saw, they feel what you felt. Exactly. And that's what kind of separates the pros who do this every single day and make a living at it than people who are just going out and doing snapshot postcard stuff.
Right. No, absolutely. And, it's sort of like, when you get a beautiful shot of polar bears, it's going to bring about that instant reaction, that instant awe reaction,
Because everybody can relate to this, right. Because right. It's the love between a mother and child sort of thing. It anthropomorphize, I think is the word, right. Is that we can all feel the same thing, but with a landscape, you don't have that advantage. You have to extract emotions from inanimate things, which makes it a lot tougher.
Right. And then of course, when you have the beauty of a unbelievable penguin here running across the rocks and everything, you not only get that awe effect, but you get that wonderful laugh for a moment too. At least that was my reaction when I saw this. Yeah. But maybe
and the key here is, and I try to preach this is, mm-hmm. Don't, with wildlife photographers, I think their initial impulse is to zoom in, is get as close as they can. Right. But sometimes, the back up a little bit. And I had to get down low and actually lay down on my stomach here to be able to get the penguin and get the mountains in the background. This is a much more interesting image because of the background, because of the blue water and the mountains and its relationship to the environment and telling a story, than just getting the longest lens in your bag and just in zooming in as close as you can, which I think is a mistake that a lot of wildlife photographers do.
I've seen enough zoom shots to last me a lifetime. What I love is what you do many, many times over. And that's why I'm so attracted to your photography and your eye. And, it's just because you like to shoot with a lot of background and very wide with many instances, and you bring in so much into the frame that you're just so gifted at doing this. But there are times, of course, where, a beautiful manatee like this or a sea cow, this is just unbelievable. Montaigne here says, Montaigne Massac says, makes sense. I was just thinking about the fact that to make good art, you have to love what you're representing or expressing.
It has to be real too. You can't fake it.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
It's hard enough to get people to connect emotionally, but if you're not feeling it yourself, then it's an impossible task to make somebody feel something that you're not feeling. That's a bridge too far.
Well, that's one of the things I wanted to get to next with you, because I know I've read your stories. I've read what what you're about and everything. And I'm in that zone too of passion and purpose in life. And to me, everything's about passion and purpose in life. So, what are your thoughts about passion and purpose in life? Because I know you've written about this.
Well, I mean, try to live life without either one of them. And it's rather empty. And it doesn't have to be, photography, obviously. You get many different passions and purposes that whatever turns you on is what my motto is. It just so happened that, when I was, it was in a different lifetime ago, I was had a real job. And it was a fine job. It was a soulless corporation, but it met all my material needs and my superficial needs, but there was something missing. It was empty. I knew that that I came across this quote: "The massive men live lives of quiet desperation." And probably many of you know this as being Henry David Thoreau, and that's who it is. At the time, I didn't know who it was or where it came from or what mm-hmm. the context was, but I knew that I knew what quiet desperation was, and I knew I didn't want to be one of those men that were mentioned in the quote. So yeah. that kind of hit me, and I knew that I had to do something, and that put things into motion to eventually plan for my liberation, my Independence Day.
I like that. That is well put. Thank you for saying that. That really is a great way of putting it. Your liberation and Independence Day. Edward's back with another great one. Edward's got a million of them. This reminds me of the stories you hear from Native Americans over the ages. The connection to the land, things of flesh and blood, and those of rock, water, etc. The idea of connection, but also of the spirit of the landscape itself and our connection to it. Richard, your work reaches us in this way on many levels. You got a big fan there.
Can I say something?
Yeah.
Because this is my passion here, but I don't in the intro you mentioned something, the quote I made about my proudest achievement being that I've never photographed a wedding. I'm not in any way dissing wedding photographers.
Oh no.
It's just that is not my passion. That is not, you know, somebody's wedding, sometimes it's an obligation you have to go, but somebody's wedding that's a stranger would be the last place that I would want to be. I wouldn't want to be there. And it would probably show in my work, even though I have probably technical skills mm-hmm. to photograph a wedding. Mm-hmm. It's that passion would be missing, because I can go back and look at images I've taken 8-10 years ago. And I've done this now during the pandemic. I'm going back over old images. Right. And I can look at a folder of a day shoot and know what kind of mood I was in. Mm-hmm. I can mm-hmm. feel like, I don't remember actually doing these photos, but I know that I was having a bad day just by these photos, or I know I was having a good day. It shows in the work. And those who could do wedding photography, great. I admire the hell out of you. Just, it's not for me. And
oh no, absolutely.
I avoid those things I'm sticking with the things that turn me on. And that's where that passion comes from. And that's, I need that in my work.
100%, man. And like you said, and I'm fully with you on that one, on anything like that. Everybody should do their thing.
A throwaway line with me about the wedding thing. And it's kind of funny, but it's true.
Right. No, I did a wedding once years ago when I used to document the NYPD. One of the cops that I used to photograph in one of the units in the 6th Precinct asked me to photograph his wedding. And I did. And it was the last time I ever photographed a wedding because it just wasn't for me. It just wasn't for me. But some wedding photographers do amazing work out there with documentary style and other things.
Yeah.
Yep. Damon's here. Absolutely, Richard. As you mature, you can recognize your love in the work, and hopefully you get closer to that zone of genius as you further in your career.
All right, Damon, I'm going to steal that zone of genius from you.
Yes. Well, Damon's an excellent writer. You have to Google him, and I'll put you in touch with him, actually. Damon's big in social media. I met him through my colleague, Sri Srinivasan. Great writer, great inspirational guy. Does a lot of work on careers and other things, too. So speaking of purpose and passion, wow, Machu Picchu, the alpaca, everything is in this photo. Talk to us about this beautiful image here, Richard.
Okay. Well, it's obviously a very iconic scene.
Right.
And I spent several days at Aguas Caliente, just being a tourist and walking around and doing my shoots and all that. And it inevitably rained every single day. My last morning, I went up and it was foggy, and you can see it was low ceiling. And these llamas are just walking around. I mean, they're everywhere. So this is not as unique as you might think it is, but when I saw that, I kind of just lined everything up and kind of scurried up the hill and got behind it, and he just stood there like he was admiring the scene too. Pure luck, but it's not as lucky as you would think, because they are just kind of roaming around the terraces and all that.
Well, I just absolutely gorgeous. I've always wanted to go to Machu Picchu, hopefully one day. But then, you know, then we have these amazing shots with light and you know, the time of day, of course, is always essential. But wow, these elephants, especially the babies walking with the bigger elephants, the mom and dad, possibly. Where are we here, Richard?
This is also Namibia, and right at sunset, a group of probably 40 elephants walked out in front of this waterhole you see here. And the light was just, these elephants, as they're walking, Namibia is a very dry country, so they're kicking up all this dust. You can see the dust.
Right.
Of course,
right.
When you have low angled sunlight backlit with dust, and then you get this kind of light, you know, just it just catches that light. And so they're walking by. I'm looking. It's just a lot of stuff going on. I'm trying to find a simple composition in there. And I wrote about this a couple of years ago when I was doing like a year in review. I don't remember taking this photo because it was just things happening quickly, and I'm shooting, and I'm trying to find something that kind of stands out. But later that evening, I'm kind of going through my photos, and there this was, and I was like, wow, I don't remember this happening. So that was a nice surprise.
Is that rare with you that you can't remember where when you've taken something? Because I know myself, I can remember almost not every moment, but a majority of them.
I can remember most. It's that this particular event was so fast. And if you shoot wildlife, normally you're just firing off a lot of shots. So I remember the elephants coming in. I remember struggling to find something to pull everything together. Mm. I don't remember that particular frame and specifically, but
all right,
I'll take it.
Well, I know this is I've seen reactions to this photo on social media and other things. This is a big, people love this photo. I love it. I love all your photos, but this is special, man, because you know, the natural beauty of these two incredible beasts with all of the mist and the perfect amount of snow and trees in the background just makes for the most incredible composition here. And it has all the elements, you know?
Yeah, it's Yellowstone in winter. And Yellowstone's a cold place. I mean, you talk about going to Iceland or Norway in winter, that's nothing. Yellowstone in winter is 10 times colder. And so you have all these geothermal features. Mm-hmm. And of course, you have steam in this just really cold weather. So you have these great atmospherics, and the bison, they're cold too. They're seeking out some of the warmth of the hot,
right?
The steam and so out of a series of images, this was my favorite because of what you mentioned. If you imagine this photo being nothing but steam in the background, it's not nearly as interesting as having that jagged line near the top that reveals some of the trees and the snow in that in the background. So
no, absolutely, I'm all about lines and angles. Everybody who knows me, all of my photos, everything I do, lines and angles, I'm a nut about them. I think they're so important, and you obviously captured them beautifully. But then, you know, we get to a moment like this, and it really the sterile, I don't want to say sterile, but the void in the background here is actually what really makes this photo to me with this beautiful, is this a grizzly? No, is this a grizzly?
It's a brown bear.
Brown bear.
Which is basically a grizzly. They call the grizzlies that
right.
the coast and feed on salmon, they call them Alaskan brown bears. Mm-hmm. And this is another good example of that anthropomorphizing, putting or projecting our, you know, what we think they're thinking to an animal that probably is not thinking. He's not. So it looks like he's just sitting there patiently waiting for the election results, the pandemic to end, but he's just not doing anything. He just happens to be sitting there, but we're projecting our emotions on him.
Aren't we?
Yeah, we are.
I think we could, if we had a comment contest right now, we could probably get 100 comments based on this. So Janet asks, what are your photography? She's cutting me off here with a real question. What are you photography now as you, I don't get that part there. I'm photographing birds in my backyard. Oh, okay. Photographing. What are you photographing now as you can't travel? I get it. I'm photographing birds in my backyard. Sorry, Janet.
I'm doing some travel here in the U.S. with my car, not flying.
Oh, okay. Okay. Yeah. So, right. Road trips are great, right?
Did a few big road trips, and I think maybe next week I'll be heading to Florida to photograph some wild birds and some other things that I've been kind of doing some research on. So I'm just waiting like everyone else for things to be safer. And I could probably travel if I wanted to. It's just that I want to be responsible too.
Of course. Of course.
I'm purposely not getting on a plane and flying across.
It's funny, you know, Richard, because every time I get on the phone with, tonight's the first time Peter DeSilva, a great photographer that's been on this show from San Francisco, it's the first time he hasn't chimed in on the show lately and said, "Hey, Steph, I'm on the road. I'm watching your show while I'm on the road." I'm like, "Peter, I hope you're not driving while you're watching the
show." Maybe it's past his bedtime.
Well, I did the show later for him. No, I'm just joking. It's so at 6:46 in San Francisco. Come on, Peter. Anyway, he's a great guy, and he's always on. He's doing a lot of road trips lately. So I hear you on the road trips, man. But let's move on with some of these other great shots. You know, I've only been around pandas, unfortunately, and I say this sadly, in a zoo. And so smack me on the hand for that one. But the thing is that the great part of this image, I'll just say it briefly and then I'll let you tell us about it, is the way you've just caught this beautiful panda right in the middle of that beautiful green bamboo with some bamboo in its mouth.
this is not a wild panda, but it is in China. It's like a frontier city called Chengdu. And beyond, when you start going like west of Chengdu, it's pretty wild, and there's a lot of panda habitat. But they have a panda center where they rehabilitate them, and it's pretty wild looking. Although they are penned, and so I did a tour of the place and kind of walked around and spent the day, maybe day and a half, and looking, just try to do something different, something creative. And there was a couple places where they had some greenery in the foreground. Mm-hmm. And so I purposely got behind the greenery and shot through it to create this like color wash.
Yeah.
So it's out of focus greenery, and then try to find a hole so that I could kind of frame it.
Yeah.
And
beautifully done. It illuminates and brings all that beautiful white and black on the panda. But the bamboo in the mouth is the clincher there. It's just perfect. I love stairs and buildings. I do a whole series in New York called Just Look Up. Everywhere I go, Just Look Up. But Just Look Down, too, and this is a prime example. What beautiful curves in these stairs. Where is this place?
This is on the Outer Banks of North Carolina, up a lighthouse looking down. There's a spiral staircase to get to the top. And so it's all open from the inside. Mm-hmm. So then you could shoot downward. And I like the shapes, obviously, but there's also just some fantastic light. There's you can see an artificial light at the bottom that's giving us that warm glow. Mm-hmm. Then you have the blue coming in through a window up above me that kind of threw this really nice blue cast on the bricks.
Oh, it's lighthouses are amazing. I've seen so many lighthouses, but I wish I had spent more time in some of them. They're a real treat to photograph, aren't they?
I couldn't remember the name, but it just came to me. It's a Currituck lighthouse.
Okay. Whoa, that's a big question there. Let's see. Lotte Bhutan asks or says, talking about passion and purpose, how much of your portfolio is prearranged, set up, fixer guide, and ad hoc on the fly? As hosts in Bhutan, he's from Bhutan. Welcome. We occasionally struggle with that since there are photographers who demand everything be set up ahead of time. It is a fine line having to financially reward the subject as much as I wish to discourage and keep things authentic and not have to create that unhealthy expectation by the locals. Thank you.
Yeah, I totally understand. I don't like setting up images, which is why I mentioned that very first image you showed about the fishermen in China with the cormorant fishermen is close to a setup as I would have in my portfolio.
Right.
And when people travel to Bhutan, they've spent a lot of money to go there. They've spent a lot of time to go there. And I think a lot of them want some sort of guarantee that there's going to be success. That's not my style.
Yeah, no, definitely not. Wonderful. I love that we have such an international crowd. Coming to us from Bhutan and everywhere else. Some of our viewers are probably going to get used to the time adjustment that we've moved from Saturdays at 10 a.m. to Thursdays at 9 p.m. Eastern. But here we are. So I want to frame this and I want to put it right on my wall, because all I need to do is sit back and look at this and just be absolutely mesmerized by the colors. Talk to us about this one, Richard.
Yeah, this is kind of semi-abstract, although there's enough literal there going that people can figure out what it is.
Right.
But it's a lava lake inside a volcano in the People's Republic of Congo, Democratic Republic of Congo. Mm-hmm. And it's become a dangerous place, the Virunga National Park. I think it's been closed for a while because of some murders. And it's been some unsettled. But anyway, it's about a 6-hour hike to the top of the volcano, the rim. And I spent the night on the rim of the volcano, slept on the ground. And because of the elevation, it's freezing, even really close to the equator. So I spent the night where half of my body was freezing and the half of my body that was facing the volcano was literally burning. But when the night fell and we had all these great little patterns on the surface of the lava lake, it was constantly changing and moving. And I've got all kinds of different compositions and concepts I use, but I really like just going with that spider web type look, that broken glass like look.
Man, yeah.
Like when a rock hits your windshield and it creates this pattern.
Yeah.
that's what I was looking for. I was, you know, just kind of telephoto it and just kind of fill the frame with the little lines, squiggly lines going out to the corners and to the edges. And it happened to be my favorite from that particular shoot.
Talk to us briefly, somebody who does the type of, you know, or until the pandemic at least, the traveling and the gear and not just photography gear, all the other stuff that one must have prepped and ready and everything. On average, when you used to, be out traveling across the world doing some of these things, what is the amount of prep time and gear and other things, you know, that you have to put together for some, going on these big exotic trips?
It varies from trip to trip. I try to anticipate, you know, obviously the kind of clothing I'm going to need, the kind of gear I'm going to need, mm-hmm. the type of lenses I'm going to need. Mm-hmm. This was particularly challenging because I had just done a workshop in Iceland in January. Mm-hmm. So I had, you know, warm clothes and I flew from there to Amsterdam and then Amsterdam to Rwanda. Mm. And from Rwanda, I spent time with the gorillas in Volcanoes National Park and then went over the border into the Congo and did this. So mm-hmm. you had a lot of different, you know, weather, obviously from tropical weather to cold weather and vice versa. But this is a challenge, but it's just a lot of it is just common sense. The hardest part is learning how to pack this. So I'm not carrying, you know, 5 or 6 bags with me or where I go.
Right. Absolutely. And, you know, the abstract nature, you know, and the beauty that you capture in so many of these pictures, including this, are peaceful, they're soothing to the soul, as I would say, and they belong on any wall, on any gallery. One of the reasons, you know, that I started this show was to make sure to bring photographers on such as yourself, because I don't care what level you're at, this pandemic has affected all of us business-wise, all of us with our livelihoods, and it is an absolute pleasure to put your work out there, and everybody should take a look at it and know that it's you still will be doing workshops in the near future and other things. Why don't you talk to us a little about that, Richard, about some of your workshops? I'm going to put up a part of your website here.
It's okay. I've been doing teaching. I find teaching to be very rewarding. So I've done some teaching now for, you know, close to 20 years, in the things that I care about and things that I'm passionate about. Recently I've turned most of my workshop business over to Munch Workshops, which is one of the largest, photography travel companies in the world, to, kind of handle all the logistics and I just kind of show up and do the teaching and it's hopefully we're looking at the second half of this year, things maybe getting back to normal. A lot of the trips have been canceled last year and the first part of this year. We're kind of waiting to hear about some of the others, but looks like Alaska in July is a go. Mm-hmm. It looks like some of the ones in September, like you see here, Morocco, Mongolia, look like they're going to be go also.
Wow. But Mongolia. Yeah, I've a friend of mine and a former guest on the show, Susan Portnoy, has been on the show, and she's been to Mongolia. And wow, the photos out of Mongolia just are jaw-dropping. They really are. So in terms of the workshops and everything, you mentioned the company that you work with. Is it Munch, you said?
Munch, yeah.
Munch, yes. I just wanted to get the pronunciation correctly and everything. So people can go to your website. They can check out the workshops, the availability, the dates that are still temporary, right? Because of the nature of things.
We're pretty optimistic about the second half of this year.
Good.
But you can go to my website. The ones that I'm doing, mm-hmm. there are a little write-up about them and then a link to the Munch workshops where you'll get more information about registering.
Right. That's right. When you click on the link and you go there to learn more, it will take
some of them. This one I'm actually doing myself.
Okay.
It's a holdover from last year, which was canceled. So we just pushed it forward a year. But a lot of these other, like Antarctica, for example, that's going to be with Munch.
Right.
Two of them in the Antarctica later this year.
Here we go. I just wanted to highlight them since they are, you know, the company that you work with and everything, the Falklands, South Georgia, Antarctica. Six spots left, folks, for later in the year. Let's get ready to fight. You know, the vaccines are rolling out, and we can only hope that everything's going to work out, because, Richard, I'm sure your workshops are something to just, to live for. I wanted to make sure that we shared that with everybody. Oh, no problem at all. So let me get back here and let me close that out. And I've lost the tab here. Excuse me for 1 second. So I know what happened because I was doing that and I was showing that. There we go. So let's get back to the other tab here with these other images. Okay, so here we go. Talk to us about the light, Richard. Talk to us about the lines as we were discussing before, and now here in this location.
Yeah, this is all about the lines, obviously. In the shadow, I mean, the light and shadow creates the lines. It's really right. So a lot of times when I talk about, you know, composition, we have to talk about light too, because in this case, it's a perfect example how the light and the shadow and light create the lines themselves. So yeah, this is definitely about the lines from the diagonal at the bottom, that dark wedge at the bottom, to the edges of these dunes, which are catching the last evening light. And these are some of the biggest dunes in the world. This is Sossusvlei in Namibia. Some of these are higher than the Empire State Building.
As far as, wow.
Over 1,000 feet, well over 1,000 feet high, and a couple of them. And
wow.
If people are walking the ridge of those sand dunes, you couldn't even see them at this focal length and this distance. They're that small.
That is absolutely phenomenal. I would never have guessed that. I would never have guessed that.
Yeah, I think 1,400 feet high is the biggest one.
Wow. But then you get to a location like this and you have the magic of the lenticular clouds, you know, above such a beautiful mountain peak. I mean, this is almost as perfect of an image as you want to get from a setting like that, I would think, right?
That was, yeah. I tell people about Patagonia, I tried to explain it. one of the things about, you know, the mountains are almost impossibly, the relief from where you stand to the top of the mountains they're almost impossible. But one of the things I like most about it is the weather. And the weather is a lot of wind. When you think of the Southern Hemisphere, there's very little landmass to block the wind as it circles around the bottom part of the Southern Hemisphere, unlike the Northern Hemisphere. So you have these mountains, which are not that far from the Pacific Ocean. So they're getting a lot of strong winds, a lot of moisture, and these lenticular clouds are created by high altitude winds, and they get stacked up against the mountains and they start lenticular, the root word is lens, like plates, mm-hmm. they stack mm-hmm. up. And when you get the right light and you've got a situation like this, and I wanted to create something almost not abstract, but something that kind of represented my personal vision here, than just doing a wide angle landscape.
Right.
And so we have got that perfectly like pyramid-shaped mountain, and then the stacks of lenticular on top of them. They're getting that alpenglow first thing in the morning. It's
man, you know you get that picture, and then you sit back and I don't even smoke, but you almost want to. If I did smoke, I'd smoke a cigarette. It's just, or I have a drink. It's just like one of those pictures that you just say, man, I nailed it. I got it. And it's a gift from Mother Nature, right? It's a gift from Mother Nature.
I couldn't have done it without Mother Nature. That's true.
No, I always say every great nature shot that I've gotten, it's a gift from Mother Nature, because without her, it would not happen. You know, I've seen volcanic, you know, black sand from volcanic activity and in Hawaii and everything. But the special part about this is the mix between the snow and the background there. Those three peaks from the Rock Island formation back there is what does it for me in this picture. Talk to us about this, Richard.
So that is actually the same formations that I talked about earlier, that are in Stranger,
right?
Except that they were taken from that point, shooting the other way at the sunrise. So this is a different different location, or different angle, but looking at the same formation there. Mm-hmm. And we had some snow, and it covered the beach except for, didn't go down as far as the high tide mark. So mm-hmm. we got this perfect black sand a curve that the eye naturally wants to follow and leads you out to the resting point, which would be the formations or the Rennesanger right. formations. And then from the bottom corner here, we've got more diagonal lines coming up from the left corner. So everything kind of pulls you in from the both corners at the bottom, diagonal line coming from the left, diagonal line coming from the right, and just pulling your eye upwards and around that curve. And it leads you to the sea stacks.
Yeah, you know, and it's also the split, the little split between each layer of snow there that's on the beach, and then the volcanic, the sand there, the black sand, you know, right in the middle of each of it. It's just the beautiful breakup of everything, but yet it all comes together beautifully, you know?
I hope it does.
Oh, no, it does. It does, man. It does. So, and then we have your Monet, your version of a Monet here, I see.
Well, that was definitely the inspiration was Monet in his water lily type paintings. And this is in Acadia National Park in Maine. Mm-hmm. And there's a backed up beaver pond where the beaver dammed it, and we had some still water, or I had some still water. I was by myself. And I was doing some shooting on somewhere else, and I drove by it, and there was this cloud up in the atmosphere. It was getting close to sunset that was reflecting this beautiful light in the water. And so it's kind of a distance, so I had to shoot at like a 300 or 350 millimeters. My only challenge was, because I'm not at a 90-degree angle to the surface of the water, is getting everything in focus, because it's kind of at an angle,
right?
With that you know, long lens. Mm-hmm. So I shot it straight on like this, like f/16, something like that. And then I tried doing where I focused on near, and then the middle and the end. I was going to photo stack it. In the end, one image did it just fine. Oh.
And
but the key was finding that balance of the blue on the top and the bottom, absolutely. And then finding the right, filling the frame with the water lilies and the reeds, so that it just kind of balances out.
Oh yeah, no, it's beautiful the way it just flows, the flow of this photo with the colors, as you said, and the breakup of that beautiful color in the middle between the blues on the top and bottom. So well done, you know, and getting a mountain, you know, you're in the mountains, you're all this amazing ice and rock formations and everything, but yet you get that moment where this comes about. Now tell me, I'm looking at this, and maybe I need new glasses, but are there any climbers on that peak?
No.
Okay.
Probably no one set foot on that ever.
Okay.
So
okay.
this is we're going through a channel in Antarctica on a taken from a ship.
Oh, okay.
And so this is actually not a mountain you see there. That's kind of a large, like a shard of ice, of iceberg. And behind it, you see the mountains, the great, the dark bands are actually mm-hmm. rock. And mm-hmm. then they see the ice and snow between them. So this is, you know, very late in the day and we're, you know, everybody's kind of shooting different things. And I just kind of caught my eye, that little wedge, a little triangle of light on that ice. Mm-hmm. And then I liked it's the bands oh. and it's all coming down.
Yeah.
It was just a little lesson or a little bit of advice to you photographers out there to yeah. shoot outdoors is this is why I don't like auto white balance, because you want to represent this as blue.
Right.
Auto white balance would have made it, you know, neutral, and the blue in the shadows is what really makes this. And that's kind of how I processed it for that, with that in mind.
Right.
So,
awesome tip. Awesome tip. Absolutely.
Whenever you want to give it that psychologically, it's cold. It's a cold place.
Oh, yeah.
You want to feel that cold, and the blue in the shadows really, it sets it off, the whole thing.
No, it sets it off perfectly. Absolutely. I agree 100%. Of course. Just spectacular and everything. And in a different way, a photo, you know, a moment like this where you have, you know, the beauty of the greenery in front of all of that cold and ice and everything in the background, but yet it's the clouds that come yeah. across the middle, right? So talk to us about this one, Richard.
Yeah, it's just a rotten day, and you honestly didn't think I was going to get much done because it was overcast and foggy and rainy, and this in April you'll get some fall color on these are called Lenga trees. Mm-hmm. It's the only tree, it's really the predominant tree, maybe the only tree in this section of Patagonia. And they get to yellow and orange and red in April, because it's obviously it's the opposite side of the world. So it's, right. their fall's in a different time.
Right.
And so I just like it had a like a Japanese painting look to it, the shape of the Lenga trees. And oh. then, you know, the mountain would come and go. It would disappear, and then it would be partially revealed. And you see there's like a band of fog there in the mm-hmm. middle. You see a little bit of the mountain toward the bottom between the right. trees, but there's like a band of fog going through it. And just a very simple image, but you know, I like simplicity sometimes with these images.
That's, yeah, no.
my favorite from the trip, it turned out.
Absolutely. The colors, the doors, that beautiful wood, and of course, walking through the street here with all of the baskets just makes it an absolute beautiful moment. Where is this, Richard?
This is a Cartagena, Colombia.
Mm.
So it's kind of colonial type architecture, a lot of bold colors. And this was not that out of the ordinary as far as the color. I like the color scheme, and I just kind of sat and just waited for someone to come by that would provide some, you know, point of interest. And this guy came because he was closing down a shop and he had all these wicker baskets, and he walked by, and I just kind of discreetly took some pictures, and worked out.
Perfect moment. Sometimes it just works out, right? Alleyways have always been a favorite of mine. Any streets, alleyways, and in many countries or anywhere I've traveled, and this one is spectacular because of the depth in it. Number one, vertically shot, and of course the subject matter in the background there blurred just a bit. Really, really beautiful moment.
That's Fez in Morocco.
I had a feeling, man.
Inside the Medina, it's like a labyrinth of alleys and subterranean tunnel. It's a crazy place. Easy to get lost, but this is almost like you're underground. And just the silhouette in the door and that little shaft of light coming down diagonally through the frame, just all worked out.
No, it does. It does. And we're once again going to highlight some lines and beautiful stripes, of course, here, which work with the lines and everything, but the angles, and look at all of those beautiful zebra heads and manes all lined up perfectly. When you're out and about with wildlife in abundance like this in a group of zebras, I mean, what is it that you're first like attracted to, and what are you focused on the most?
Yeah, I think exactly what you see here is what I was attracted to. It's the diagonal lines, mm-hmm. but created by the heads and the eyes, and then you have diagonal lines going up into the upper right corner. But it's a lot more difficult to shot than it probably looks, because they are they're animal prey, and they're very nervous, and so they're all approaching the water hole at the same time. And when their head is down, they're very susceptible. Now, there could be a lion hiding in the bushes just, you know, to our left. So they're very skittish, and to get all their heads down at one time was hard, because they would constantly, you know, look back up and look around, and then one would move up a little bit, and then the others would move up. So they were constantly breaking my little composition that I had in my mind that I wanted to capture. Right. And they would look up, and then somebody gets spooked and they all jump, and they you know, get out of the water completely. And then they slowly come back. And but getting all their heads down at the same time in that fashion,
it took a while. That's why there's that moment there where that one zebra in the background there has its eye just above the rest of them. And that's that moment that you're talking about, right?
When I wanted to fill the frame. I didn't want any of the landforms behind it or any of the dirt behind it. I wanted to fill the frame all with zebra.
Right.
And but obviously the lines are what makes it. But you can see it, that one kind of looking up in the back. But
yeah.
But normally they get to the water like that, and one will push forward a little bit, you know, the mm-hmm. you know, 2 or 3 feet, and then mm-hmm. another one will catch up. But having all like that, all their heads down at once.
Well, the one thing that I love about photos like this most of all is that the more you look at them, the more you find, of course. Yeah. And now I'm looking even tighter, and I'm looking at that one below there that has its mouth behind the others, but yet mm-hmm. in the water there. You know, there's all these beautiful elements. That's why I miss going to galleries. I love looking at photos online, but I miss going to galleries and standing there like the, you know, art lover that I am, to watch, look at these photos and examine all the little different elements, you know? So, and then you get to the wide open plains and wilderness there. And you get this beautiful moment. Talk to us about this one.
Yeah, this is on the Serengeti Plains in Tanzania. And, you know, a lot of it is just, you just kind of prepare some of this luck. But, you know, and then having a good guide that will put you in that spot, you're back up. No, just another foot. No, back 2 up 3 feet. And then the giraffe moves and no, up forward, another 4 feet. It's just very responsive to, you know, what I'm asking. And I'm sure he was just hating me, but just getting me in that right spot. And then once, you know, you're there and you get the head up and,
Well, I mean, head up, man. This is what, you know, when you go out, if you were going on a safari, but you on your travels and expeditions, period, even your workshops. I mean, this is the moment that many, many people on your workshops probably live for, you know, but it's more than that. I mean, of course, your workshops are comprised of so many different elements, I'm sure. You know, yeah, Eileen.
I was alone here on this one.
Eileen says, great show, Stefan and Richard. Your photos are stunning. Thank you, guys. Eileen told me yesterday she was going to make sure to tune in because she loves wildlife and nature photography. I know that I had a bunch of people from LinkedIn. We're streaming the Spin It Social Hour to YouTube, LinkedIn, Twitter, and Facebook via StreamYard. And I know that a lot of people on all the platforms are looking forward to seeing your work. So, you know, we go from one beautiful giraffe shot in the wilderness to in the wild to another here. You just don't get better than this right here. This must be one of your, in my opinion, award-winning photos.
it's one of my favorites.
Yeah.
Because it's not your typical, you know, just shoot animal. It's there's some design to it. There's a little bit of mystery to it.
Yep.
I think having some mystery in a photo is important and something I constantly strive for, mm-hmm. because with some mystery, you're inviting the viewer into the photo. So they are a participant, not just a passive viewer. So there's a little bit of mystery. There's some people have figured it out. And it's just something a little bit different. It's a different.
Oh, it really is. It's stunning. You know, I when I saw this photo, it brought me right into a J.R. Tolkien, you know, story. I feel like a hobbit's going to pop out. Where is this? This is absolutely spectacular.
This was on the Blue Ridge Parkway in North Carolina. And this is a tree that I photographed before. And Being that, you know, in the pandemic, I, you know, was looking for, you know, some familiar places that I would go shoot again. And I photographed this tree many times. This is on a trail at an area called Craggy Gardens. And there's a little pinnacle trail. And this, yeah, they're right. This tree has kind of a Tolkien-esque look to it. But I never got it photographed. This is going back to what I was talking about before, about pre-visualization and shooting things over and over again. Never got it with the fog. And I've always said I want to come back with the fog. And, you know, I'm traveling all the time. I don't have time to go up and shoot this. But on this particular day, I'm driving by and it was foggy. And I remembered that tree and I went and photographed it. So you see the trail there on the right that kind of goes up through the tunnel and into the little tunnel of rhododendrons.
Yeah.
But the tree is it's a fantastic tree.
No, it is. It is. I love photographing trees. I love photographing trees, even that have been toppled over in storms and everything else. They're just works of art a lot of the time. I've never been to the Carolinas. Well, I've been to the Carolinas, but I haven't spent a lot of time there. And I hope to one day. But, you know, then you and I had a giggle over this one the other day because I said to you, I was standing right there on those rocks about 2 years ago. And he says, well, you think you were, but you probably weren't. And you know what? You were right. I was in one spot and you told me about it and then tell us about where you were.
Yeah, I knew exactly where you were because it's a popular place and it's hard to get photos without photographers in it. Right. This is a spot called Hunter Cove Beach. Mm-hmm. And it's very similar with the cobble rocks and the
Acadia, Colorado, right?
In Acadia National Park in Maine. And so, yeah, this is, again, it's, you know, I talk about, it's easy to get seduced by the literal beauty of places, but literal beauty is not going to carry many images, particularly when there's a million of them on, you know, Instagram and Flickr and Flickr PX.
Right.
But having the literal beauty is great, but you need that abstract quality. And this, obviously you can see the lines that are created by the shoreline. It's a zigzag pattern. You see the line from the bottom left leading to the right. And then you got the edge of the shoreline on that takes you back to the left again, and then back up to the right. So it's all about being able to see abstractly, and the literal beauty is great. And that's going to get people's attention. But in order to hold that image together, you need to be able to see the elements that are below the surface.
Oh man, let me tell you something. I just want to just sit here and just look at this all night, man. It's just absolutely just the perfect moment. But I wanted to talk to you and touch on a point. We've got about maybe 10 minutes left. And I wanted to talk to you about the point about social media that you made, or you brought up social media for a brief second. I want to segue into that for a minute. How does, you know, a lot of photographers, listen, I come from a photography background, 20 years at the New York Times, now 10 years plus as a social media and visual consultant. I've worked with the Pulitzers, et cetera, et cetera. But the thing that I wanted to talk to you about was, how does a photographer, many photographers aren't even on Twitter, or they don't really take to it that much. You have built a following of over a million followers on Twitter. Talk to us about that. That is, it's phenomenal. It's phenomenal.
Well, I think a lot of photographers are overlooking a great opportunity for one. I got on very early. I saw the value of social media, you know, going back to, I think, 2006, 2007.
Right.
It's just really things were changing in the photography world. And, you know, what a perfect way to be able to interact with people who like your work, you know, directly. You mentioned the 30 photographers, whatever though, 30 influential photographers, whatever. So, Twitter, asked me to help consult them on making Twitter a more photography friendly place.
Wow.
Engagement. They saw, you know, everybody's a photographer now because of cell phones and everything else. This is an opportunity that we're kind of overlooking. How can we make this more photographer friendly? And so one day we're on a conference call and we're talking, and they said, you know, you do know that this is all about your audience. And I said, well, wait, I thought this is all about me, right? This is no. Study the responses you get. Mm-hmm. Says, the next time you post an image, don't just like skim through the responses. Right. Don't just, you know, like them all or read them. Study the responses. Mm-hmm. So the next image, like 2-3 days later, I posted an image. I think it was in Tuscany in Italy or something like that. Clever composition. I posted it 24 hours later, went back and looked at the responses, and 2/3 of them were typical responses, you know, great shot, love the colors, great composition, or, you know, it sucked or something like that. Oh, typical stuff.
Brutal, man.
But then I'd never noticed this before, that 1/3 of them were responses didn't even mention the photo. It was something like this. We were there in 2006, mm-hmm. and we stayed at the XYZ hotel, and we went to this winery, and, you know, I climbed the hill and I ate some grapes, and I'm reading. I'm like, why are you telling me this? You're not even talking about my photo. They want to be able to connect with you.
I do.
Like this. And they said, yeah, that's about 1/3 of them. Ned didn't even like mention my image. Mm-hmm. They wanted to tell a story about themselves.
Right.
And so, you know, without giving away too much, but I try to leave a door open to allow them to come in and be a part of it.
Wow.
And that's in addition to engaging and posting regularly and all that kind of stuff, everybody else does, but try to, rather than just being like a viewer that's looking at your photos and that's fine, invite them in, leave a door open so that they have an opportunity to come in and tell about their experiences in the same place.
No, like I always teach my students at FIT and other places, you know, you want to bring people in, you want to welcome them, you want to make them feel included in your world. And then the other part is that it's about storytelling, and your images are stunning, but people also want to hear the stories behind a lot of them. And that's one of the beautiful reasons I am honored. And I'm really thankful for you spending the past hour and 20 minutes with us. I have to tell you, it's been a joy. It's taken us around the world, and you've made us all tonight, besides the other great accomplishment this week, you've made us all feel a lot, lot better. Let's read Rose's comment here. Rose Horowitz, study the responses. People at Twitter told Barnaby Photo. Oh, she's okay. Rose is actually tweeting out for us tonight. Thank you, Rose. What a wonderful. She's actually putting out some of your information, live tweeting for us. She's a colleague of mine, just doing that out of the generosity of her heart that she's a great woman. So thank you, Rose. Rose Horowitz 31 on Twitter, folks. Please follow her. So, Richard, like I said, you've brought some joy into our lives tonight. You've brought some beauty into our lives tonight. We wish the same for you throughout your travels, throughout the rest of the year. We wish you to be safe and healthy and just have a better second half to 2021 than, unfortunately, the way we're starting 2021 out with certain things. But we'll get there. So any parting words, Richard, that you'd like to
say? I appreciate the invitation, Stefan, and the honor's all mine. And there's a lot of fun. We have to do it again sometime.
Yeah, no, I the reason I put this show together, like I said at the very beginning, I don't reiterate it throughout the show. This is not that type of show. I love to get the word out about all the photographers, but I try to keep the marketing even with the balance of the photography and the great discussion and the storytelling, number one. I hope that you enjoy telling the stories this evening. You know what? I'm not going to let this one pass up. There's a little rumor that there's an alligator out there with your name on it. Somebody wanted me to ask you that question, so I have to ask, and we'll close out the show with one of the weirdest questions you could probably close out a show with.
we talked before we actually went on the air. Somebody did some serious research, because this goes way back. But
Hold on one second. I'm going to bring Jonathan on for that one, because we have to acknowledge my great co-producer who does so much work on this show with me, helping me keep it together in more ways than one. Jonathan, you dug up this one for Richard, didn't you? You're muted, Jonathan. You're muted. Jonathan, you got to unmute.
I'm unmuted. I am guilty as charged. I'm the one who dug up that fact.
So, Richard, Jonathan, we want to know, what's this alligator story, man?
I was in a kayak, and I was with a guide, and we were going down this Blackwater Swamp in coastal South Carolina, and there's alligators all over the place. But this one where I kind of turned my kayak in its direction a little bit, and it came into the water, and it was like running on top of the water, all four with its mouth open, right toward my kayak. And then at the last minute, just kind of went under it. And our guy was like, that's never happened. We had to report it to the DNR because there was like she had a group of brownie Girl Scouts or something coming the next day. And it turns out that they're mating, and this is being just aggressive. And they captured it, and they relocated it to a different place where there wasn't as much kayak traffic. And they named it after me. So,
oh man, that is what a wow! Look at that, man. You have an alligator named after you. I think that's only perfect for somebody who captures so much of the world around us. So, all right, brother, listen. We're gonna take it to a close here. I have a couple of things to do. Would you stay with us for a minute? I wanted to just say goodbye to you backstage and everything. Jonathan, thank you for that great closing question there. You nailed it with that one, buddy. Thank you. Okay, Jonathan Borstein, everybody, my great co-producer. Thank you. All right, I'll be right back, Richard. Okay, hold on 1 second. I'm going to take yours so I can, folks, this has been the Spin It Social Hour. Now on Thursdays at 9 p.m. Eastern time, every other Thursday, I should say, twice a month, check us out, follow us on YouTube, Twitter, Facebook, and LinkedIn, coming to you live on all these platforms. And as I said, once again, my name is Stefan Kaplan. I am the creator and founder of the Spin It Social Hour. This has been our 38th show, and nearing number 40. I can hardly wait to get to that big 5-0. But it's been an absolute pleasure to bring on these great photographers every week. And in 2 weeks, I have to get used to this. In 2 weeks, on February 4th, let me put the card up so I can show you. Yes, on Thursday, February 4th, we are going to have a great photographer on, an avid Leica user. His name is Edward Leskin from Allentown, PA. And you can check out some background on him at steelworkersarchives.com. Edward has done phenomenal work around the steel industry in Pennsylvania for many years, and he's going to tell us all about his work and show a lot of his beautiful work, photography, and I can't wait to have him on. He's a huge fan of this show. He's been so supportive of everything we've done. Edward, I can't wait to have you on. It's going to be great. So once again, on February 4th, join us for Edward Leskin. And I wanted to close by mentioning one more sponsor that I do a lot of work with. His name is Emilio Pardo, and he's a really visionary brand strategist out there. I work with him putting together a new show. We're going to have a new one coming up soon, but it's called Real Talk, Live from the Barn. And it's a show revolving around all aspects dealing with COVID, the economy, jobs, and everything else. Let me give you a quick intro, and then we're going to say goodnight.
Hi there. Welcome to Real Talk Live at the Barn.
All right, folks, it's a wrap. And I can't wait to do another Real Talk show with Emilio soon. And I have to tell you, I want to thank you for your time. Join us Thursday, February 4th. Please be safe. Please take care. Mask up and be well. Thank you very much, folks. Good night from Stefan Kaplan.